So it's always a pleasure to have our good friend Ken McLeod join us here at Many Rivers Books and Tea and on our radio show, The Mystical Positivist. But of course, given the extraordinary events happening in the community this week, Ken called the other day and said, "Are we still doing this?" And I said, after a brief moment of reflection, yes. And I'm glad we are, because there is, it seems to me, no better time to look at the possibilities of human capacity and transformational possibility than in a moment of stress such as our community is currently experiencing with the currently raging fires. And so I'm really glad that this topic of Vajrayana in the West is the topic tonight. It's something I've always wanted to know about, and I can think of no better person than the author of these books that you see over here to my right, your left, and others as well. So please join me in welcoming Ken McLeod to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you very much, Rob, for a very generous introduction. As Rob said, we're in this rather strange time where there are fires raging in so many different parts of the county, and an extraordinary number of people have experienced devastation, which I find difficult to imagine myself. I've run into, just in casual conversations and moving around the county a little bit the last couple of days, run into probably a dozen people have lost their homes. And I think it's up to something like 5,000 now, 5,000 homes have been destroyed. So it's made the last, I don't know whether it's been like this for you, but for me the last three or four days has been, had a kind of surreal quality. And it's the first time I've been exposed to a prolonged period of such extreme uncertainty. But something certainly my parents lived with in the Second World War and so forth, not something that's been in my experience before. So, and I'm sure it's affected all of you. One of the things that I have noticed, and I've had a few conversations along these lines, is the devastating as these situations are for many, many individuals. It also brings out the very best in humanity. I've been deeply impressed with the extreme efforts that the various authorities have put into just trying to manage the whole situation. I think they've been doing a fantastic job. And now more help is flowing in, so some of them are actually taking the first shift in like 3 days off to get some rest. And also all the volunteers and the outpouring of help in the community, taking people into their homes, and helping people find people and helping people get food, taking care of babies and trying to keep the, you know, just the ordinary aspects of life going in very, very extreme circumstances. So in a certain sense, I feel a bit strange talking about such an esoteric topic as Vajrayana Buddhism. I would like to get a little knowledge about where you are in relationship to this topic. So I'd like to ask a couple of questions. How many of you have any background in Buddhism? Okay. And how many of you have any background in Tibetan Buddhism? Oh, okay. That's encouraging. Because it's Vajrayana is most closely associated with Tibetan Buddhism, And I'm not quite sure how to say it. I often refer to Tibetan Buddhism as a Baroque mosaic. One of the things that has always made it very, very difficult is for people to understand is how utterly self-referential it is. And there's very good reason for this. Tibetan culture did not change very much over the course of 1,000 years. That's a kind of stability that we here in the West find really beyond imagination. But the fact is that I can read a book in Tibetan written 1,000 years ago far more easily than I can read a book written in English 1,000 years ago. I can't understand that book. The Tibetan book is just like picking up anything that was written, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50 years ago. So this evening I want to make it clear where my comments are directed. So one of the things that many of us who've been teaching for a while in the West have noticed is that over the last 2 or 3 decades, basically two or three different strands or approaches to practice have evolved. The first is that many people approach spiritual practice of one kind or another with the aim of making their lives better. Now, in times of yore, the way that you did that was you went to the local monastery or the local priest or the local shaman, and you asked him or her to do a ceremony to make the rain fall on your crops, or to ward off the hailstorms, or to protect your family against famine or plague or whatever. That is how you made your life better. You know, you asked for protection, you made offerings for that, and so forth. Today we've advanced considerably beyond that. We now have this whole self-help industry. So we don't go and ask anybody. We go and get training in one thing or another. So now we have mindfulness for this and mindfulness for that. But it's all about how to make your life better, how to be more focused, how to be less reactive, how to get rid of stress, etc. And a lot of it's very, very good stuff. It really helps. I like to liken it to the development of aspirin. Aspirin used to be derived from willow bark. You had to pound a lot of willow bark to get a little bit of acetylsalicylic acid. And then the German pharmacists in the late 19th, early 20th century figured out how to synthesize this particular compound. And as a result, they could make it in vast quantities. And so everybody got the relief from headaches and minor ailments, and we have aspirin with us to this day. But it's not the same as pounding willow bark. And I see a lot of the things that have developed out of spiritual practice as being the kind of the spiritual equivalent of the development of aspirin, which may be a little unkind, but it's been tremendously beneficial to very large numbers of people. The second thing that people come to spiritual practice for is to participate in a community of like-minded people. And we see this in the development of churches, we see this in the development of synagogues, and this has always been the case. You bring people who share a certain set of values and they can participate in and do things together because they have the same values, they develop bonds of trust and mutual support in various ways. And we see that has developed very much in the last 10, 20 years in Buddhism. And not so long ago, like about 5 or 6 years ago, a person did some research into what was the primary thing that people were interested in spiritual practice for. And the overwhelming one was to be part of the community. So particularly in our society today, where things are very fragmented, people want to be want that kind of companionship and interaction with people. And certainly in times like we have right now, those communities become very, very important facets of the society, because they're able to organize and bring people together and bring resources together. And then the third is for the oddballs, in which I would include myself in this category. It's for those who approach spiritual practice because they're really looking for a fundamentally different relationship with life. They're curious. Sometimes they're driven by great loss. Gampopa, one of the great teachers of the Tibetan tradition, 11th century. His wife died. He was a doctor, and his wife died, and he couldn't cure her. And he was so devastated by that he just had to find something about the meaning of life, or something like that. And that's what led him into spiritual practice. So it can be like that. Some people just have a natural calling for it, a natural bent, in the same way that some people have musical or athletic or mathematical talent. But people coming from that, or coming from that kind of interest, they're not particularly interested in making their lives better. Nor are they all that interested in participating in a community of like-minded people. They want to know something. Now, I think it's fair to say, and it's one of the reasons I asked those questions at the beginning, that all of you have that part of you, that there's a part of you that has that inclination in you. So tonight I'm going to be speaking to that part. Not the part that wants to make your life better, because Vajrayana Buddhism really doesn't make your life better. At least not in any way I've been able to figure out. And not really about building community or participating in community, because it's so heavily based in retreat mentality and exploration of what one might like to call the deeper aspects of life, but I think just certain aspects of life. So Vajrayana is very much oriented towards the mystic. Now, people say, well, what do you mean by mystic? Mysticism. It's got a very bad reputation in the West, but my view of mysticism is that it's the interest or the pursuit of a way of experiencing life that does not depend on the conceptual mind. In Christianity, one talks about a direct experience of God, but that's pretty easily translatable into the terminology that I just gave. You know, it's immediate. And that's probably the most important quality of what we call mystical experience or mystical knowledge. There's no intermediary. It's very, very direct. And it's that kind of direct relationship with life that the mystical part of us is interested in. Now, there are some challenges to that. And the challenges to it are actually quite a few, but I just want to name a couple. One is language. We are so used to understanding everything in language or through language that we don't know what it is to have the direct experience of something. And you notice that everybody, I mean, suppose you take someone who's an avid botanist, a florist, you know, loves flowers, or someone who's an avid bird watcher. Let's take a bird watcher. What's the first thing they want to do when they spot a bird?
Categorize.
They want to name it. And this is what I mean about language. You just want to put a name on it, because then it fits into a whole scheme. What would it be like to experience the world without names? What would it be like to operate in the world without names? And most of us actually find that quite difficult to imagine, because even in our imagination, we find ourselves dependent on language. So once we introduce the notion of language as an aspect of life and think about letting that aspect of life go, we have a big challenge. And how deep this challenge goes struck me once when I was living in LA and I was listening to NPR, and I heard this report about the extent to which a group of scientists had figured out how to decode the noises that whales made in communicating with each other. And they had figured out that the whales had names for each other. There was a certain sequence of sounds which was repeated and referred to this whale or that whale. And when I heard that, it occurred to me, like, wow, if they had names for each other, then they have to have names for themselves. That each person will have a name for itself and must know that name at some level. And then I went, oh, does that mean that the sense of self is dependent on language? And that all of us we hear about in Buddhism about non-self is simply a way of talking about the possibility of experiencing the world without language? Well, that's an interesting idea. So I just want to plant that one for you to think about. That maybe that's what we're actually doing in Buddhism, is rediscovering a relationship with the world that we've forgotten because of the development of language. Yes?
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Please, and please feel free to jump in on this, because I'd like... happy to have more of a discussion than a lecture.
So there's a distinction I've experienced in this space where in the course of a meditation practice I can have the experience of the naming function receding.
Yes.
And so it's not that unusual to attain to a place that where, you know, if you say don't think about an elephant, I can not think about an elephant.
You which know. Is more than most people
yeah,
can.
Yeah, right. I understand that's work, and it's the product yeah. of work. But like, if I look at that cup filled with water there and go to that place where the word isn't present, the thing I notice is that the concept doesn't feel very far. Even if I'm not repeating a word in my head, and I can be present to the sensory reality. And I distinguish that from a much rarer experience. I remember once when I was the editor of the school newspaper in college, and it was a long night, and I was laying, you know, this is back in the day when you had wax, you know, you would lay...
So I was
laying a page, the word 12 down, and I remember looking at the word 12, and for a moment there, suddenly I lost the understanding of language, and the shape just looked really strange, but I was aware that I didn't know that at that moment. And that seemed distinct, because it was like the concept really wasn't there then. Whereas yes. when I look at the cup there, I have to apply a certain kind of interior pressure to keep the concept at bay, otherwise it comes rushing back. And so when you talk about living non-conceptually, it feels to me like there's a level of perception that our whole sensory apparatus, you know, configures for us that is leads us right to the concept.
Yes.
And I want to understand if you're talking about just being at the place beyond where the concept is present and dominating our experience, or are you talking about something much further where we sort of lose actually the relationship to the conceptual period?
Well, I wasn't making that distinction.
Yeah.
So let's include both of them. I mean, what came to mind when you were describing is an exercise that I would sometimes do with people in my meditation groups. And if someone was very stuck on the notion of language and of the need for thought, I would take out my keys and without any warning just toss them to them. And they would always catch them. And then I would say, okay, give me the keys back, and say, now I want you to think about catching them. And they would almost always miss them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I would use that as a way of demonstrating that thought actually is a an extra layer.
Okay, so that's clarifying in terms of what I'm asking.
You had a question?
Yes.
Could you speak up?
Yes, I can do that too.
Thank you.
In my practice, nature is what I call a non-word-centered language, that everything is talking back to with everything else all the time. So it has helped me to free words of that bondage of being, of almost being idolatrized.
Yes. Yeah, this is exactly right. James Karras talks about this in, I think it's The Religious Case Against Belief, which is a very, very nice little book that he wrote. But nature is completely indifferent to humanity. And so our fundamental relationship with nature is silence. And it, I mean, even if the wind's rustling, nature doesn't talk to us. It just does its thing. I'm doing its thing terribly right now. But I think you're right that when one of the reasons people like to go into nature is that they can experience what I'm talking about almost naturally because of that, you know, very profound silence of nature. You can talk to nature all you want, and there it is.
Relating with an atom.
Yeah, it can be similar, exactly, yeah. So, this is the direction that mystical practice often takes, is identifying and freeing ourselves of the veils, which, or whatever other word you want to, screens, or whatever other word you want to use, that are between where we are now and that direct immediacy of direct experience. Now, I think language is a particularly good example here because we take language for granted. Very few of us are aware of how thoroughly conditioned we are by language. And you know, our whole nervous system is conditioned by language. And there are many other forms of conditioning that we have too. So one of the essential aspects of mystical practice is to break down, untangle, whatever metaphor you want to use, all of these different veils or screens or impediments, whatever you want to call them, what gets in between us and that the immediacy of direct experience. Now, how many of you have tried to change something in your lives about yourself? It's, you know, and how successful. You know, it's not so easy. And and when we change one thing, we find that all kinds of other changes ricochet through our systems. So one of the aspects of mystical practice, which goes back, you know, literally thousands of years, is that it's a good idea to have someone who knows the path. And this puts us in the domain of the teacher. We can call it teacher, we can call it guide, call it spiritual director, whatever. Or, you know, we can use Eastern terminology, Lama, Roshi, Lumpur, whatever. There are all of these, but rabbi, priest. But all of these are refer to someone who has some kind of knowledge of this path and what it takes, and they have a repertoire of tools that they can use to that they can teach so that we can use them, and They also are very intimately acquainted with the stuff that gets in the way and can identify the stuff in you that's getting in your own way. And that's really the function of a teacher. One is it's to show the possibilities. Two is it's to train in the methods. And three, it is to point out the internal material that's getting in our way. Now, realistically and practically speaking, a relationship with such an individual is not exactly a social relationship. And because of that, and particularly in our day and age, it's become very confusing for people, because these people tend to do, at some point or other, things that are socially questionable, shall we say. Because their aim and our reason for relating to them is because we're trying to step out of the domain of ordinary experience. So we find ourselves in a very, very different environment. Once we start responding to the mystical part in ourselves. And issues of trust and faith and appropriateness, all of these come to the surface. And this is what has permeated, particularly, I think, the Tibetan tradition. Because in the Tibetan tradition, we have had, until recently, a vibrant spiritual tradition before it had ever made contact with the modern world. For most Tibetan teachers, their first contact with the modern world was when they fled Tibet in 1959. And this puts them in very, very different positions, say, from the Japanese tradition, where Japan went through a period of adjustment to industrialization, going back at least to the middle of the 19th century, and somewhat later perhaps in Southeast Asia, but being occupied by colonial powers, they also had plenty of contact and adjustment. And Tibet just came right out. And this is both a very wonderful aspect of Tibetan Buddhism, but a highly problematic aspect. Because those of us who started to make contact, in my case, back in the early 70s, he just didn't know where to start. And we had the rather odd situation of the most radical elements of Western society interacting with the most conservative elements of Tibetan society. And this was true of the other, of Theravadan and Zen as well, but it was kind of heightened to an extra degree with respect to Tibetan. And just to give you an example, my own teacher, who is from the far east of Tibet, his area of Tibet, whether it's Tibet or China, was never clear. He had heard rumors of the First World War, but he'd never heard a whisper about the Second World War until he came to Bhutan in 1956. And we can't imagine that. But this is why I say it was a pre-modern society, you know, basically doing things the same as they had been for centuries. Now, there is a tremendous amount of confusion because in this interaction, and there are two that I think are really, really important, which are, and I do not know what the future will be in the West, but in the Tibetan tradition, there are two very distinct kinds of loyalty or allegiance which were completely conflated. The first kind that is of interest to us is the natural trust or devotion you have in your spiritual teacher, the person you are seeking guidance in mystical practice from. And that's often characterized by faith or devotion. And the second kind is, because Tibet was basically a feudal society, is the loyalty you have to your feudal overlord. You know, you're a vassal, here's the lord, he gets protection, and you provide revenue from your fields and things like that, but you have to do what he says. She says, but almost always the he. And these were inextricably linked because of the structure of Tibetan society. Now, how well is that going to fly here in the West? And so this is the first aspect that I want to offer you about Buddhism, Vajrayana in the modern world. Here in the West, we are not going to tolerate that feudal fealty. You know, people just won't put up with it. We're far too independently minded. We're not going to... People who accept that kind of slavish obedience aren't going to be engaged this practice in a fruitful way for the most part. And virtually every one of us who have delved into Tibetan Buddhism have what you might say authority issues. How many of you would describe yourself as having authority? Yes, okay. So we don't need to go much further down that road. So that is going to make a very, very big difference in how Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana manifests in the West. Frankly, I don't know what the answer is. My idea is that we will probably evolve something that will look like Vajrayana in India before it came to Tibet. And what that means, it'll be, except for the few institutions which seek to retain the Tibetan structures and so forth, and there will be some of those, Western practitioners are probably going to find themselves in relatively small groups, small, probably up to 50 to 75 at the most. Those are groups where you can actually know everybody. Centered around a teacher or maybe a tradition of teaching, possibly. But the primary relationship, the only relationship will be that of, this will be their spiritual guide, and they won't have any other allegiance to that. So that's a very, very different structure right there. And of course, this brings in the whole matter of how are such teachers supported? And I think there are various possibilities in that. One that I don't think would be bad to emulate myself is the Sufi model, whereas in which most Sufi teachers had their own source of income. You know, they were business people, or they were teachers, or something like that. They engaged in professions or jobs that left them enough time to be able to work with students, but they were not dependent on their students for their livelihood. There still might be some kind of monetary exchange, because that's not inappropriate, but there wasn't a dependency relationship. So that's one possible model, which allows both student and teacher to focus only on the spiritual direction. And I think there's a lot of value in that. When it gets tied into other things, it gets messy, as happened in Tibet and has happened in a lot of other cultures as well. The second aspect, which someone pointed out to me relatively recently, is, I think, also very, very challenging. And I'm not sure where this one goes either, and some of you may have some very good ideas about this. In the East, for the most part, and particularly in Buddhism, Buddhism tends to be epistemologically based. That is, it's all about knowing, how we perceive, how we experience things. Western thought and our whole philosophical tradition has much more ontological orientation, where it's about what what is this, and what is being, and being and non-being, and things like that. These are questions which Buddhism has always skirted as being, I'd say, like, that's just a rat's nest, don't go there. It just gets in the way. That these have been very important questions in Western philosophy and in Western spiritual practice. The previous Pope, for instance, wrote an essay on, which has caused a lot of attention because of various reasons, but the question was, is God rational? And that is a question that, if you translated that into a Buddhist context, it would be like asking, is emptiness rational? And when you do that, you can see immediately it just doesn't make any sense.
Emptiness.
Is emptiness rational? You don't even know where to start. So, so I offer this as an example of how deeply embedded in being and existence Western thought is, which means that those people who are willing to step out of that framework and really look for a different way of approaching and experiencing things are necessarily going to be relatively few. So that's one of the reasons why I tend to distrust organizations which attract large numbers of people, because they know something must be wrong there. That may be just my cynical side, but there it is. Now, yes?
May I ask, when you said the question, is God rational?
Yeah.
Does that question mean the same as, is God only rational?
I'd have to go back and reread the paper. I don't think so. I think there was basically the idea is God subject to the laws of reason? You know, that's what it means to be rational. And this was presented by the Pope at a conference of an interfaith conference. If I remember correctly. And I just found the question absolutely mind-boggling that it could even be posed. Because, and here we get into a little technical stuff. In Western thought, and this goes way back to the Greeks, we have the three laws of thinking, which, if I remember, there's identity. A is A. A is not A. Consistency, and then the big one is the law of the excluded middle. A is either this or not this. Okay. That, and those are the laws that govern rational thinking. The huge mistake, which I think goes back to the Greeks, Jim will be able to comment on this more than I, but I think goes back to Parmenides, is that somehow or other these laws of thinking started to be applied to experience and then to things. And that's where things really break down. Because once you start applying to things, then you can say, I can't be happy and sad at the same time. But you can. And, you know, Stuart was talking about this cup. Well, if you're in the Zen tradition, you know, I might hand this to say, what is this? And the demonstration would be, drink out of it. You wouldn't say what it is. That would be a direct experience. But it may be a cup, but from a mathematical point of view, it's equivalent to a donut. So it's got one hole in it. And it could be many, many different things. Wittgenstein would say, it depends how you use it. Whatever you use it for, that's what it is. So maybe it's a hammer. Have you ever used a cup to hammer in a nail, something, tack or something? So this whole business of God is rational is, to me anyway, is confining God to the rational mind or the conceptual mind. And that just, that is what made no sense to me whatsoever. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. So, I pointed out two things so far where I think there's going to be, where we'll end up in the West, I don't know. But these are certainly issues we're going to have to deal with. One is relationship with the teacher needs to be embedded solely in spiritual or mystical practice and not be conflated or combined with other roles, because that leads to a lot of problems unless you set up a whole society around that. And we already have a problem in our society with this, is so many teachers have training in psychology that they operate as psychologists, and the difference between the being a psychologist or a psychotherapist and being a spiritual teacher is becoming very, very confused. I've heard very prominent teachers who are psychotherapists say, the only difference I can tell between the work I do with my students and the work I do with my clients is that my clients pay me and the students make donations. Well, to me, there's a problem if that's the case, because there's a lack of clarity somewhere or other. That is a very deep connection, a very strong connection that's already formed, and maybe it'll work out, maybe it'll be problematic, I don't know. The second thing that I mentioned is this ontological versus epistemological orientation, which is challenging for all of us. I've heard so many questions, and I've had to translate many questions, which are ontologically expressed, but when you try to translate them into Tibetan, you cannot express them that way. And I remember an exchange between a very prominent Western teacher and a Tibetan teacher, and it took about 15 minutes for the Tibetan teacher to understand what the problem was. It's because she was asking from an ontological point of view, and finally he said, no, that is irrelevant for the subject matter that we're discussing. You can't talk about being here or existence or anything like that. And we see this when we, you know, how many of you have, you know, wrestled with this notion of non-self? Okay. And this is very important, because we take that ontologically, that there isn't a self. And there's been endless debates about that. What does that actually mean? But if you look at it from an epistemological view, it means that there's a certain kind of experience. It's not a fact, but it's a way of experiencing things. You can experience things without the sense of self operating. And that's in the direction of that kind of immediate direct experience that I was referring to earlier. But that doesn't necessarily translate into the fact of there isn't a self. If you see what I mean. So a lot of Western practitioners are on this extraordinary wild goose chase where they're pursuing this phantom of never having a self in operation. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. Freeing yourself from the influence and distortions of that particular way of experiencing the world, that's a lifelong work. But positing it as fact, that's something else entirely. Does this make sense to you? Okay. So there are many, many areas like that. But I want to turn to another facet of Vajrayana. How many of you have heard of Yidams? Deities. Yidams. Is there... Do you have a Tanga here, Rob?
Well, there's actually this one right up here.
Yeah, so the one up on the wall there, it's a little difficult to see from this distance, that's full of Yidams. These are these many-headed, multicolored, many-faceted deities which are used in meditation. Now, in Tibetan Buddhism, you can say that there are
paths.
There are many, many paths, but I'm just going to say there are three main ones. I introduced the notion of non-self a few moments ago, and the possibility of experiencing life without that self operating. Well, one of the most reliable, not just in Tibetan Buddhism, but all in any form of spiritual practice, is the practice of devotion. And in the practice of devotion, you forget yourself through the power of devotion. And that's a very important practice within the Tibetan tradition. That devotion is usually directed at one's teacher, not necessarily. But that very, very strong devotion where you lose any sense of self in the experience of profound devotion has been a very reliable path for many people in many traditions throughout history. Deity practice operates in a very different way. It has a devotional element, but basically you forget yourself by imagining that you are something else. And here again, we run right into the ontological, epistemological difference. I don't know how many times I translated the question to my teacher, does Chenrezig actually exist? Now, Chenrezig, for those who don't know, is the Tibetan word for a very well-known Yidam or deity called Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit, or Kuan Yin, or Kanon. Kuan Yin in Chinese, Kanon in Japanese. It's the embodiment of awakened compassion. How many of you know St. Seraphim's Church here in Santa Rosa? If you look at the up in the dome of St. Seraphim's, it's down on Santa Rosa Road, isn't it?
Santa Rosa Avenue,
Upland. Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
I think it's a mountain.
Yeah.
But it's a modern Russian Orthodox church, but they've done traditional frescoes in it. It's absolutely beautiful place. Not a very large church, but if you look up at the dome, the fresco up there is the figure of Christ. But it says the Lord in heaven looks down and listens to the sufferings of all beings, and the parallel of I haven't got the wording exactly, but it's almost identical to the wording for Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of awakened compassion. Now, this was my teacher's favorite deity to give people. You imagine that you're the embodiment of awakened compassion. I'm going to have more to say about that in a minute. And people would ask him, does Avalokiteshvara, does the all-seeing one, which is the English translation, does it actually exist? And my teacher would always reply, yes, it actually exists, because people have had dreams and visions of him. And right there you have the epistemological, ontological difference. You know, the fact that he can be experienced means that it's real. And people just couldn't get this. They want to know that he existed in some other kind of way. Like it was real. But, you know, when you try to track down what is real actually refers to, that gets really difficult. I remember reading Philosophical Investigations. Wittgenstein poses, suppose we're sitting here and a chair suddenly appears right there and then disappears. What would we say? We'd say the chair was an illusion. But suppose it appeared again. Then we might say its disappearance was an illusion. But what if it appeared again and disappeared? Then what would we say? You know, and that's what I love about Wittgenstein. But, you know, what does the word refer to? But this is all about the ontological basis of our thinking. It's so deeply embedded in us. But for Rinpoche, have that vision. Oh, okay, relate to that. It rises in the dream. There it is. And so, Tim, you had a question?
Well,
I'm terrified of your questions, but go ahead.
Well, my understanding of this question about the ontological status of visionary experiences, whether they're dream-induced or meditatively mm-hmm. induced, has to do with the understanding of the Buddhist nature of causation. So a yidda, the experience of a yidda, arises due to causes and conditions. From a Western perspective, that is its ontological status. But so does a chair arise due to causes and conditions. And so they have the same, they arise due to the same causal matrix. And that's why in a Buddhist context, if someone is asked, is Avalokiteshvara real? Is Kuan Yin real? The answer is yes, because the experience of Kuan Yin is a causally conditioned experience in the same way that a chair is a causally conditioned experience. But in the West, since the 17th century, there's been a tendency to privilege sensory experience.
Oh, right. Yes.
And that's part of the dilemma of Western culture at this time. So that sensory experience is ontologically valid, and non-sensory experience is not ontologically valid. And that they, at this time in Western culture, they're viewed as ontologically different. But from a Buddhist perspective, with dependent origination, they're not viewed as different. Does that make sense? Or am I being too?
I find that fascinating, and I really appreciate you that comment. I had not made the connection before, but I think you are right that since the 17th century, which is basically when science moved in and natural philosophy evolved into physics and what we know now, then objective what we would call material, gained a privileged status over all other forms of experience. And I hadn't made that connection, but I think you're right. I think that's where the problems begin, right there.
And that we're raised with that distinction. It's second nature to us.
Yeah. It's and so it's very, very hard for us to step out. This is real in a way that no visionary experience. But as you say, for Buddhism, no, this is the visionary experience, and this arises through the same kind of process. Yeah. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay. So going back to losing yourself by imagining you're something else, which is essentially what's going on in deity practice. Well, the number one thing that this requires is a pretty decent imagination. And that is also something that has been seriously eroded in our society. Ursula Le Guin, who's a wonderful science fiction writer, talks about this in her writing workshops, among other things, where she says that a society that has lost its ability to imagine is in a very bad way. And being the storyteller that she is, she feels that the primary role, or one of the primary roles of storytellers, is to nurture the imagination of the society. And that may be why there's such interest in storytelling again these days, in a way that there hasn't been for a long time. But again, we run into this ontological, epistemological thing, because I have this body which I relate to in a very, very solid way. It's actually very, very difficult for me to imagine that I could have a different body. But some people are able to do that, and their minds actually become so quiet that they can forget about this body and actually imagine being in a completely different form. And that brings about a completely different way of experiencing the world. And this is essentially what one's trying to do in many, many traditions of mystical practice, is to understand that the way that we experience this world is in a certain fashion, a certain sense, arbitrary. It could be something else. And so there are many, many other possibilities. And the recognition that there are other possibilities loosens the hold on this one, and that allows us to move more easily into an immediate and direct experience. I think that's basically one of the rationales for this kind of approach. Now, can it make such a difference? I'm very much, I think it does, because I'm thinking here of Suzuki Roshi, the teacher who founded San Francisco Zen Center. One of his students, Yvonne Rand, told me once that when he went back to Japan, and in Japan, Suzuki Roshi was regarded just as a very low-level country priest, and they just thought it was completely nuts that the Americans were making such a fuss over him. Who's he? He wasn't anywhere in the ranking. But he went back to Japan, and he was invited to give a talk. So he gave this talk in Tokyo, and the Japanese president went, these Americans are nuts, we don't see anything special in there. But then there were a few of Suzuki Roshi's American students in Tokyo at the time, and they asked him to give a talk. And some of the Japanese who knew English went over and listened. And they came out and they were absolutely amazed. Because Suzuki Roshi was a different person in the other language. And I don't know how many of you have learned another language, but if you have, you find that you are a different person in another language. And it's the same, and by learning another language, you learn how many things are dependent on your own language, which you thought were just how things are. And I know, I had that illustrated to me when I had to translate the question, what is the meaning of life? I had no idea how to express that in Tibetan. I found out it cannot be expressed in Tibetan. There is no way to ask that question. And when you say, okay, there's no way to ask that question in Tibetan, then what question are you actually asking in English? You know, it just raises these questions.
I guess it raises the question of what questions can be asked in Tibetan that we can't ask in English.
Oh, just... don't get me started. there's so many that you just... because, and again, this goes back to this mythological, ontological thing, because it's just Tibetan is set up to express that stuff. The language was developed to express Buddhist concepts. It's rather like cobalt.
I'll quote you on that one.
I don't think I even originated that one. Cobalt is a business language that was developed in the 50s and 60s for the purpose of programming business problems on computers. Don't try to find the square root of 2 using cobalt. You'll have a very bad time. But if you want to file a lot of files, it'll be very easy. And Tibetan Buddhism, the language was developed to express Buddhist concepts back in the 8th and 9th century. And that's why translation into it was so straightforward. So, deity practice is about using your imagination to experience being someone else so completely that you realize that the self, the conditioned self you have now, is in a sense arbitrary. And that opens up all kinds of possibilities. Now, there is nothing that I know of in the West that is comparable to this process in Tibetan Buddhism. The two closest things, and they aren't really very close, are sorcery, as we commonly understand it, or witchcraft, or magic, whatever you want, where you conjure things up through ceremonies, and even less so the spiritual exercises of Ignatius Loyola, where you imagine going through the stations of the cross like Christ, which is basically a very important purification practice in the Jesuit tradition. But none of those are as complete or as well developed as the deity practices in Vajrayana. Now, it's fair to say that the deity practices almost certainly evolved out of the sorcery cults of ancient India. They have all of the accoutrements of magic. You have mantras, i.e. magic spells. You have mandalas, magic diagrams. Powerful use of the imagination, the development of special powers, and so forth. What makes Vajrayana unique is that all of those sorcery elements were co-opted for spiritual purposes, and which is quite extraordinary when you think about it. And I don't know of many other cultures where that has happened to the same extent, certainly not to the same extent. So what happens with deity practice, or if we go take it a little deeper, what happens to this spiritual path that consists of imagining you're something else? I have no idea what form that will take, and it's difficult to imagine, except for those communities that seek to preserve something of the Tibetan tradition, that deity practice will be terribly widespread among Westerners, if only because it's a relatively complex practice. And we lead extremely complicated lives. In Tibet, life in Tibet, particularly monastic life, was relatively simple, so you could engage a complex practice. But most of us who lead complex lives, we want a very simple practice. We don't want more complexity. And so I'm not sure what's going to happen there. Then the third track is an area of Tibetan practice that is shrouded in mystery, and I'm talking about protective practice, protectors and dakinis. And interestingly enough, to my knowledge, certainly in my own training, I did not read a single book on protector practice. We did it all the time, but there's no text which explained it. And I'm just starting to think about, now, why is that? Now, what is protector practice? Well, if you look at Tibetan tantras, you'll see some which have these absolutely nightmarish forms, you know, big black forms holding bags of pestilence and sticks which represent your fate, and some of them are very distorted. Ekachati, for instance, is the Nyingma protector, which is one eye, one tooth, and one breast, so very, very distorted. These are the stuff of nightmares. You know, multi-headed, some of them, flames, very wrathful. And I remember when I was talking with Rinpoche about a retreat I was going to do, doing a very important Yidam practice. He said, well, you have to do Mahakala, which is one of the big protectors, in the evening. I didn't know anything about it. And he didn't care whether I knew anything about it. He just said, do this ritual in the evening. And those protector rituals are done absolutely faithfully every evening. And so when that much emphasis is put on, you've got to ask why. And what I've come to reflecting on this, because we did a lot of this stuff in the 3-year retreat that I trained in, is that, as I talked about earlier, we are working with very, very deep levels of our conditioning of language, conditioning of the kind of cultural conditioning that Jim referred to, where we're steeped in a kind of materialistic approach to the world, and we're trying to undo that conditioning. Now, when you loosen that stuff up, you release all kinds of energy in the system. Everything reconfigures. And, you know, as a discussing with a friend the other day. He says, I said to him, the purpose of practice is to disorganize you, to disorganize the conditioned you. So as that stuff breaks down, which is the actual intent of the practice, you find yourself dealing with aspects of yourself that make absolutely no sense. To give you one small example, at one point in the three-year retreat, I think it was the second or third of the big deity practices, and these were very complex, elaborate practices. I was 30, I guess, at the time. I became absolutely convinced that my life was over, that I was never going to be a success. I'm 30 years old, right? I'm never going to be a success. I'm never going to amount to anything. And this thought started to arise in my meditation, and it arose consistently and incessantly for 2 weeks. Just day and night. This is the only thing. I'd sit down, do the practice, and I would just think, I'm never going to get anywhere. It's all over. It's a failure. And then it went away. Like it'd never been there. And it was only afterwards I realized, oh, this is what happens when you do these kinds of practices. Things start to fall apart, and all of this other stuff, much deeper stuff, comes up. And that's why you hang out with nightmares. So you build a relationship with these very, very dark forces because you're going to encounter them. And I'm going to translate this into something that's a little more practical in our lives, because this is where I want to go here. So what is the purpose of protectors? The guru, the teacher, that the purpose of the guru and the teacher is very, very clear. It's to show you the possibility of enlightenment, the possibility of awakening. The purpose of the yidam is very clear. You know, you identify with something to change your relationship with yourself. What's the purpose of all this protector stuff? Well, the traditional wording is to create conditions conducive for practice and to remove conditions which are not conducive to practice. Sounds good, doesn't it? But it's a bit like sending a general out to wage war for you. When the king sends a general off to wage war, if he's a good general, he takes a look at the situation and he decides what to do and how to do it. And it's just possible that he may look at the king and say, you're a bad king. I mean, you're the problem. We're going to get rid of you. That can happen. It's happened more than a few times in history. So here are the protectors. They're going to create the conditions conducive to practice and remove the conditions not conducive to practice. Now, generally, we think that means that they're going to get rid of all the disturbances in your life, so you have a nice, peaceful life, and everything goes right, and now you can do your practice, right? But suppose you're pursuing your career and you're earning a nice little income, and you get a nice house, and you settle down, and things get so comfortable that you start to forget your practice. Then what are the protectors going to do? Well, they're going to take away your job, they're going to take away your house, and so forth. Because those are the conditions that are going to be conducive to practice, because the very nice situation is not conducive to practice. So it gets a little tricky. Now, when I'm talking about the protectors, it's easy to think that I'm talking about forces outside us. But it's not really that way. How many of you have experienced some time in your life, something that just in you that just decides to go in a certain direction, and there's nothing you can do about it, and it makes no rational sense whatsoever? If you have any kind of mystemonization, you probably run into that. You know, I trashed a scholarship, took off for India. You know, no rational sense whatsoever, but here I am today. So, when we talk about the protectors, it's not necessarily what's outside us. It's not necessarily what's inside us, because from a Buddhist point of view, that outside-inside distinction is meaningless. I mean, there are huge debates in Buddhism, the self-power and other power. That's basically the inside-outside argument. We even have self-emptiness and other emptiness, which is a little different. But all of these are come from different people's experience, or people's different experiences. So whether you choose to anthropomorphize it in terms of things outside or anthropomorphize it in terms of inside, it doesn't really matter. Is that there's stuff that moves in our lives, that takes us in directions as a response to what we feel this calling is. And so to me, what the purpose of the protectors is, how they operate here, is that you forget yourself by meeting whatever life presents to you. In that sense, what we have in our conditions today with the fires raging is that this is affecting people in our community and us, and it's just a case of meeting it, not judging whether it's right or wrong or whatever. It is just, how do we meet the situation? When we meet the situation with immediacy, the self drops away. We just find ourselves responding to the needs of others about us with no particular sense of self. And this is one way you could imagine the protectors operating. So, again, what happens to that as things move into the West, I really don't know. Something like that is going to be necessary, because there's something like that in almost every mystical tradition. I don't think it will take the same kind of basically sorcery-influenced manifestations that we have had in Indian. I mean, basically we're talking about Kali here in Indian mythology. But at the same time, I hope it does take a kind of mythical form. Another teacher of mine, a teacher in the Theravadan tradition, encountered a lot of difficulty in his life. He went back and read one of his favorite books, which was The Gods and Deities of Ancient India, or something like that. I can't remember the exact title. Because in ancient times, we used gods as metaphors for our internal processes. You know, all the peoples that hung out, or the gods that hung out on top of Mount Olympus, Zeus and Aphrodite and Pallas Athene, these represent different aspects of our psyche. That changed, going to the 17th century again, into mechanisms. And we increasingly used mechanisms as metaphors for our internal process. This is what Freud contributed. You have defense mechanisms and all this internal plumbing. Now our internal metaphors for our internal processes are computers and now algorithms and information processing. But I think it's a very open question, particularly when it comes to mystical practice, which of these metaphors is the most useful? And I tend to think it is the anthropomorphic figures, you know, the gods and deities and so forth. Why? Because these were like people. You could actually negotiate with them, and they had many faceted sided personalities. An algorithm is, that's just rigid. It just does what it does, and it does it automatically. And by using those as metaphors for our internal processes, we are saying that we are just automatons. And I don't think this is a terribly healthy way for us to relate to ourselves, particularly in the domain of mystical practice. So those are some of my thoughts about what Vajrayana might look like in today's world. And I probably left many, many more questions than I provided answers, but I hope I've given you at least a little food for thought. Questions? Please, Paul.
How could I go about practicing Yidam practice today?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, any number of Tibetan teachers will be happy to give you a Yidam introduce you to that. There are Western teachers who do that too, not many of them, because just not be that kind of transmission hasn't happened a lot in Tibetan Buddhism for many reasons, one of the principal being that Tibetan is a refugee society, and so they need to maintain that, to maintain their culture, and that's very understandable. So I don't know what the answer to that. There are lots of people that say go and study with this teacher, go and study with that teacher, but I don't know what I'd recommend myself, frankly. It's something I'm thinking about, because I don't know the answer, or I don't know what the Western equivalent is at all. Why do you want to? And I'll come to you in a sec. Why do you want to?
Well, one thing that I've noticed in my life is, in certain situations, there's a lack of confidence, and
you don't have more confidence. Okay, I will give you your idiom.
Okay.
Your idiom is about your confidence. Vajra confidence. Vajra is a symbol for something that's indestructible. Okay? That's how you engage every situation, as Vajra confidence. Now, what happens when you even think about that? Terror?
Yeah.
Okay. Engage the terror with Vajra confidence. Now we get extra Vajra terror in there. But that's how it works.
Okay.
It leaves you absolutely no out. One of my students came to me and she said, I'm a loser. That's the internal image I have. I said, great. You're a Vajra loser. She said, what the hell are you talking about? I said, you engage every situation. It doesn't matter what situation you go into, you've already lost. It's hopeless. And then this look of sheer terror crossed her face. Because if she engaged every situation from the point of view that it was already lost and it was absolutely hopeless, then she was free to do whatever she felt was right. Because it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So, you're about your confidence. There's your head up.
Okay.
You touched very briefly on the continuation of this practice in the West. You thought the Sufi model, first of all, you didn't touch upon the, you didn't articulate that 99% of the Tibetan teachers were incubated in monasteries.
Yes, you're quite right. it's a deeply, deeply based in a monastic and hermetic tradition.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you touched upon one of the few mystical traditions in our world which discounted that model, which was in life.
Yeah.
Married, children, working, and yet still was able to be a guide to the mystical
yes.
experience. So, do you see a way to go from one to the other?
Well, no, I don't see a way to go from one to the other. I'm a translator. I've done quite a bit of translation. And while I was very loath to admit it at first, it's now very, very clear to me that when I translate a book, I'm not producing a copy or a version of whatever I'm translating from. I'm creating something that is absolutely new. And a translator I read said the words that were most that she hated to hear the most was, "What a faithful translation." Then she knew she had failed as a translator if somebody said of her translations that it was a faithful translation. Because the only faithful translation is an exact reproduction of the original. You know, are you familiar with the Italian phrase, to translate is treason? You know, and traduttore, traduttore, you know, or translation is treason, as it is. And it's well known in translation circles, and it's there's quite a bit of truth in it. But I now think of translation as more akin to what Verdi did with Shakespeare's operas, Shakespeare's plays. You know, he take Macbeth, put it into operatic form. And if you've seen Macbeth as a play, and you've seen Macbeth as an opera, well, you can recognize the story, but they're totally different. And, I mean, A Trackless Path consists of a translation of a 18th century mystic, a very Jigme Lingpa. And but it's in modern English. I like to think that it conveys the spirit of the original. I mean, when I translate, what I try to do is to write the English in such a way that the reader will have an experience similar to the one that I have when I read the Tibetan. So I don't worry about word for word necessarily. I'm trying to recreate an illicit experience. So the reason I'm going into translation is that in the translation of Vajrayana into the West, we are going to create something very, very different. And what I tried to highlight were some of the areas where it's going to be profoundly different. And so that's why I don't see it as a path from one to the other, where I think I see it much more as people like me, people like you, those of us who have engaged in these areas and devoted a very, very big portion of our lives into that, trying to inspire or create something which will be in some way comparable or, you know, carry the spirit of the thing. But I don't think we should try to... I think we should be very... broad-minded in where we look for models. And then there's one other aspect which weighs in here, which I didn't allude to, and that is the analogy with the arts, and particularly with music. I think there's a lot to be gained by looking at how artists have evolved in the West, because they used to be the same way. We used to be in the monasteries and you apprenticed with somebody, etc., etc. But you don't do that anymore. But the relationship, particularly in music, ballet too, I think, but let's just take music. The relationship between a music teacher and student is very, very comparable to the relationship between a spiritual teacher and student. Not only that, musicians and many other forms of artists too, they know what renunciation is. Because many of them have lived long periods of their lives on the edge of poverty, struggling with their art. That sound familiar? So, you know, I think that these are fruitful areas to look for models, but I have consistently, for the last several years, quite a few years, encouraged people to think broadly and to experiment, not to slavishly follow existing models. When we see that they really don't work, when I got to LA, my motto was, we won't do what we know doesn't work. Not sure what we will do, but we won't do what we know doesn't work. Does that respond to your question? Okay. Other questions?
If you had your translation of Jamjon Kontru, that is it more like you're talking about now, the translations you're doing now?
Yes.
In the book, yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about the Great Path of Awakening, right?
Right.
Yeah, that was the second book that I translated. The first was something that Kala Rinpoche wrote for Westerners. It's called The Writings of Kala Rinpoche. It's a very small book, and if you recall, I did that translation, but I put in these, you know, very very extensive footnotes, which a lot of people really expressed a lot of appreciation for, because they made the text understandable. If I were translating it now, I would absolutely change the title. I wouldn't say The Great Path of Awakening, I would say A Great Path of Awakening. And you know, the difference between the definite and indefinite article just opens up all kinds of possibilities. It's a great path, and it is a great path of awakening, but it's not the only one. And if you go on my website, or if you go to unfetteredmind/mindtraining, and I can't remember where it's hyphenated or not, you'll find a section of the website where I give 3 or 4 line pithy commentaries on each of the 59 instructions of that. And those are in modern language, so that will give you an idea of where I would come from now if I were to do that again. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm in a program that is doing the 3-year retreat in daily life.
Yes.
And we started the 6 yogas of Sukhasiddhi.
Yes.
And you know, like you said, I'm at that stage. So my question is, I'm losing, you know, you know, what the purpose is, you know, in the sense of, would you say that it's about integrating our realization in daily life would be a...
Oh, heavens no.
No.
Oh.
Yeah.
That...
Thank you for saying that.
No, I mean, people talk about that all the time,
yeah.
And it is such a mess. it creates endless amounts of confusion and pain for people. Just talk about integrating it into daily life, because they feel that they should be a certain way in their lives, and they never are, and so it just becomes a mess. Now, you're doing the 6 yogas of Sukhasiddhi. Very wonderful set of practices. If you go on my... Oh, no, it's Nigama. I wrote a guru practice for Sukhasiddhi, but I need to write another one because I'm not happy with it. The 6 yogas, and I didn't touch upon this area at all, the 6 yogas, and whether they're Sukhasiddhi or Nigama or Naro or the Jordruk and the Kala Chakra or Anu Yoga and Dzogchen, these are all practices of a genre one calls energy transformation practices, where you're learning how to use the energies of the body to generate similitudes of awakening, with the idea that it's easier to just to fall into awakening. They're difficult to practice. Well, one of the problems here with the Tibetan tradition is that there seems to be a whole middle range of mid-level practices that never made it from India to Tibet. In Tibetan Buddhism, you either have very elementary energy transformations or extremely high level, such as the 6 yogas. There's just nothing in between. So we come into this with virtually no relationship with energy and are suddenly trying to operate way up here. And it creates a lot of problems. I would strongly recommend that you practice either Qigong or some form of possibly pranayama or yoga, simply as a way of training your body and your mind in various, and you can do that in conjunction with this. Qigong, I think, is quite helpful. Relatively simple level Qigongs, but that will help train, accustom your body and give you the vocabulary of energy. And then I think you'll find your understanding of what you're trying to do in these six yogas, it'll make more sense. Okay? But a talk about integrating, no, it's not about integrating. It's about developing high levels of energy so that you're using that level of energy to power intention and go to direct awareness. It's not about integration in daily life at all. And it's really meant, these are really, isolated retreat practices, not stuff you do walking around. That's my view on it, anyway. Okay. Any other questions, or do we need to close here, Robert?
Well, we could close, and then you can open up to other individual questions.
Okay. Yes. All right.
Can
I say a word before?
Oh, please do. Okay. I have words, and you have words.
Okay. thank you very much for coming this evening, and thank you very much to Rob and Stuart and Jim for hosting these events and for the many rivers. I'd like to say I think having these kinds of bookstores is wonderful because you can't do this on Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. There's just no way. So I would just like you to encourage you to support Many Rivers because it's something that's very important to Rob and Stuart. They make this possible, but in turn, I think it's up to us to support them. Through the purchase of books or whatever, so
like these ones over here.
Well, it doesn't matter. any of these, it doesn't matter at all. But I've got to know Robert, Stuart, and Jim since I moved here a couple of years ago, and very, very good friends, and I really value what they do here, and I'm very happy to support them in any way that I can. I'm very happy if you can too.
Well, let me just then extend my thanks on behalf of Many Rivers, on behalf of all of the staff of Many Rivers, on behalf of the community. Thank you so much. I have about 10 dinners worth of conversations to have based on just what I've heard tonight, which I look forward to over time. And I thank you all for coming tonight. And this has been a wonderful event at a time that has, I definitely sense a redirection of the energy that was present when we started.
Yeah, it does feel a little differently from when we started.
Yes,
yeah.
It feels good. Yes, it does. It does feel good. I also point out we have a donation bowl over there. We share half of those donations with our speakers to further their work. Of course, as I already pointed out, we have some of Ken's books over here and other books, as he pointed out, elsewhere in the store. We hope you'll come back and visit us another time when those are more available. And I'm grateful.
Well, my pleasure.
Thank you.